turn that on in the back.
Can you guys hear in the back?
Okay, can everybody hear me now? Okay, I will do my best. I apologize for the electronic glitches, even though it wasn't my fault. But I apologize nevertheless. As chair of this session, we have to accept responsibility starts at the top, and so I guess I take responsibility. Hopefully, it's not going to affect the nature of this session, because I want to make sure that three things happen here. Number one is that each of us have an opportunity to tell you people out there and discuss what we think of the book. It's an author meets the critic session. The second thing that I really want to do in this session is give George Smith the opportunity to respond to our barbs and our snide comments, or whatever ephemeral barbs that we hurl his way. And then third and most important for me, because I'm very much an advocate of democracy, having been a retired political science professor in California, is give the voice of the people, all of you out there, the opportunity to respond and give your feelings about this book. And the session deals with George Smith's magnum opus, Nauvoo Polygamy. Let me just throw one question out to all of you. How many of you have had an opportunity to either read this book or read into it? Let's see your hands. Hey, that's great. I think this will be a great session. So that's why I think the audience portion of this will really be an important part of this. As you're aware, George Smith's book is a massive 700-page tome reflecting... Oops. Bell's going off now. Reflecting the author's long-standing interest and research into this topic spanning some two decades. And the outgrowth of this, in part, was his editing of the William Clayton journals during the early part of the 1990s. Although the focus of the book deals with polygamy and plural marriage as practiced in Nauvoo, the author begins his narrative in chapter one with the precursors, or the antecedents, of plural marriage, and attempts to place it within a broader historical context, which I think is one of the strengths of the book, which I have more to say about later. He does that in chapter one, and then the bookend chapter, the chapter at the end, chapter nine, he deals with a fervent group of Anabaptists in Munster, Germany, who practice a very strikingly similar form of polygamy to that practiced by the Mormons under the leadership of Joseph Smith in Nauvoo. This took place during the height of the Protestant Reformation, during the 1530s. So that's just kind of, but the heart of the book, as I say, is Nauvoo polygamy. And that's just kind of an overview of the book itself. Now, let me just introduce the panelists that are going to be participating in this discussion today. Our first panelist who will be responding is Marianne T. Watson, who is a freelance genealogist and family historian. She resides in Lehi, Utah, the mother of nine children, the grandmother and of seven. She was born and raised in plural marriage. She's a Mormon fundamentalist affiliated with the All Red group. She is a graduate of LDS Business College, Salt Lake Community College, and the University of Utah. In 2000, she authored Voices in Harmony: Contemporary Mormon Women Celebrate Plural Marriage. She's presented papers at numerous other conferences as well. Now, our second panelist is a Mormon feminist. We got a fundamentalist and we got a feminist. She joined as Cheryl Lund Bruno. She joined the LDS Church at the age of 19 and has been, what she describes, as a spiritual seeker ever since. She is part of a vanguard of Mormon writers using the new media, the blogosphere. While living in Vernal, Utah, she began blogging and spewed her angst onto the internet as bored in Vernal. She self-identifies, as I said, as a liberal, liberal feminist pacifist Mormon, and writes on a variety of topics related to these issues. She is a stay-at-home poet with 8 children. Boy, 8 children. Okay. Cheryl's research interests lie in Old Testament studies as well as 19th century polygamy and 20th century fundamentalism. Now, our author, George Smith, doesn't need any introduction, but I'm going to give him a little bit of for those of you who might not be familiar with George. He is a graduate of Stanford University and New York University. Grew up in Southern California, correct?
Partly New York.
Partly New York, partly Southern California. But he married a woman who went to the same high school I did. I always kid Camilla. She graduated from Jordan High School like I did. And there is a fundamentals connection there, because Jordan's most famous graduate, as some of you in this room might know, is Warren Jeffs, who graduated in the class. Wow, you know, it used to be Gene Fulmer, the boxer, but now our most famous Jordan graduate I guess he's engaged in sort of sparring and that, in different kind of sparring now, but that's another story. So there is a connection there. There is that inner, you know, the Mormon universe is so small. But anyway, George is the founder and current publisher of Signature Books. The Mormon community owes a great debt to George for all that he's done to further the open dialogue and discussion and publication of topics dealing with Mormon studies. I would say in many ways he's the godfather of liberal Mormon studies. You can make him an offer, he won't, you know, don't make him an offer, he can't refuse. But anyway, anyway, those are the people, and I'm honored and pleased to be a part of this this panel. I guess I can claim credit or condemnation for organizing it.
How many children do you have?
One. How many children do you have, George?
Five.
So I'm kind of the weak man, the weak link in the chain here. I've only got one daughter and one grandchild. How many grandchildren do you have?
Five to be six.
Congratulations. So anyway, that's our panel and the format of our discussion here. I've talked way too long, and I apologize for that. The format of our discussion is going to be as follows. As I suggested at the beginning, we're going to be talking about 3 basic issues relative to this book, and each of the panels will be addressing each of the 3 questions. And they're pretty simple and pretty straightforward. The first question we're going to discuss is what we see as the strengths, the attributes of Mormon polygamy. And what we will do is we'll go through, each one of us will address that question, starting with Mary Ann, then Cheryl, and I'll put my 2 cents worth in. And then George will have a chance to respond to that. But then the second question is, what do you see as maybe the shortcomings or the flaws of the book? And we'll try to give George even more time to respond to that if necessary. And then the third question will be, what do you see as the overall contributions or significance of that of the volume? And so that's why I call this a roundtable discussion, because we'll talk about each of those 3 questions. So I'll start with Mary Ann, and then we'll move forward in that order that I've stated. Thank you.
I was asked to present a fundamentalist point of view, which is always very challenging. Is there such a thing? Wherever there are 2 fundamentalists, there are at least 3 opinions. This has been a really interesting ride for me. Because I experienced the principle both as a grandchild and a child and as a wife, I have had to filter this through my emotions, and so it's, do I talk from my head or do I talk from my heart? There's an old saying that goes, he who is good with a hammer thinks everything is a nail. And I think that statement kind of summarizes my overall impression of George Smith's novel Polygamy, in the fact that he seems to presume that he is really good with a hammer and asserts that all the evidence can somehow be proven to be a particular brand of nail. Well, I didn't want my opinions alone, so I had sent an email out to a large list of fundamentalist Mormons and got some responses back rather quickly from actually an interesting variety, almost equally split between independents, the Centennial Park fundamentalists, the Davis County Cooperative or Kingston fundamentalists, the AUB fundamentalists, and independents. I think I sent somebody twice. And plus one mainstream Mormon who considers herself sympathetic to fundamentalists. 50% of those who responded had never heard about the book until my email. 18% had heard of the book, but had never seen it or read it. And of those, half wanted to read it, with varying degrees, some very anxious and some put off. One of the young men that had heard of the book but didn't see it said that he was afraid that it was often interpreted through a modern eye without any contextual appreciation of the practice of polygamy, meaning he didn't think George Smith had any experience in it. So, and I could appreciate his remark, because certainly I filtered everything through my own particular lens of having lived it. Eight of the people, well, I'll just go briefly. This is going to take too long if I go completely through it. I'm going to read you excerpts for some of those that actually did review it. One college-educated woman who partially read the book gave these responses. Never liked the title. It's a dependent clause. I found the cover to be a foot off. I especially disliked the eye on the spine. I left the book on my nightstand several days while I was reading it, and I hated seeing the eye every time I glanced in that direction. It seemed weird and annoying, and I finally just decided to remove the dust jacket, stash it while I read the book. The author allowed his low opinion of Joseph Smith to influence the overall tone of the book, using derogatory terminology to characterize Smith's actions and intentions. To what extent did the author's bias influence the material, that was selected to be included in the book, and how was it presented? I have not recommended it to others because of the author's bias. Diary accounts and personal accounts I found to be very valuable because I have no other means of accessing them. The author's bias is my main objection. I quit reading after a few chapters. I would prefer to read Todd Compton's book or one of several others that offer diary accounts or personal documents but do not have the same bias. Another respondent, who, by the way, was my friend who considers herself sympathetic but is a mainstream Mormon and teaches seminary, said, I was so excited when it came out that I bought a copy online right away. I didn't know anything about the author, but it appeared scholarly, and I thought it would be a great resource and have good information. I confess I started reading it, but put it away very disappointed after probably 30 to 40 pages. His tone was so negative concerning the prophet that I found it offensive. It was not damaging to my testimony, just saddened me to read his editorial comments and inflammatory language. I am sure many people would agree with the author's take on a principle they don't like or understand to begin with, but I felt as if he was mocking something sacred in the name of scholarship. It is his right, but it's my right not to read it. I would like to get through it for the information's sake, but I don't know if I ever will because of the tone. Man that told me that he contacted me in person and said that he had thoroughly appreciated the book, though he felt that the author was clearly biased. He said his book is marked up with the word bias in hundreds of places. He said he has cited data and information, but not the book itself, in Priesthood Lessons. Another college-educated woman wrote, it mentions celestial marriage in the subtitle, which is good. It got my attention, but this author really does not understand what celestial marriage entails. The book cover was okay, not sure why only one half the faces were shown. Overall impression was that the author did a great deal of research, and I found some new things in here. It contained a lot of names, dates, places, and interesting historical facts, although some inaccuracies, and she listed several. Yes, I would recommend it to anyone interested in the history of plural marriage if they understand the author has an agenda. She thought that some of the strengths of the book was the huge amount of research and Appendix B listing Nauvoo polygamous families. She wrote, I didn't know my grandfather had 8 wives. I only thought he had 6. And in her comments, she wrote, the author obviously dislikes Joseph Smith and thought him a man of little character. Because of that, he came to some wrong conclusions on how celestial marriage was, is taught, and what it means. My own experience of the book was very similar. My husband and I were excited about the book. We bought a copy right away. I subsequently began reading it with a highlighter and a red pen. Well, first we perused it. We went completely through it and perused it. And then I began reading it with a highlighter and a red pen. But I soon put it away, disappointed after the first few chapters. And didn't finish it until I was asked to be on this panel. I felt that my initial responses to the book were confirmed in several places. Well, throughout the book, but I was particularly concerned about the comment on the fifth page to the end where he refers to the marriage customs that Joseph Smith established, quote, spawned similar lecherous prophets and submissive girls that plagued the early LDS church. And I couldn't help but feel that that was directed to Joseph Smith as it was anyone. Clearly, the author intended... I also had a difficulty with the way the author used some of his primary source documents that in several cases I wrote in the margin. I think I want to find the original or get the original because I wanted to see the context and see it for myself and not just the excerpt. But can I get you to hand me my water?
Oh, yeah.
I'm getting it dry now.
Can I get...
I guess the one that bothered me the most was the excerpts in the beginning of the book, right from the very, very beginning in the introduction and on the first chapter where he's introducing Joseph Smith's wives, where he's quoting from the letter that Joseph Smith wrote to brother and sister Whitney and their daughter, and etc., meaning his daughter, Sarah Ann Whitney, who he had married 3 weeks before. On page 9 of the introduction, which was repeated on page 53, he quoted the letter saying, my feelings are so strong for you. Come and see me in this lonely retreat. Now is the time to afford me succor. I have a room entirely by myself, the whole matter. And in this context, all kinds of visions but suggesting an intimate liaison can be attended to with the most perfect safety. I know it is the will of the Lord of God that you should comfort me. On page 10 of the introduction, he compared Napoleon's kisses, soulful kisses, to Joseph Smith's request for succor, which he said appeased one desire, in other words, sexual passion, in each of these two men. Several other references were made to this would-be salacious letter in subsequent pages, all with the same flavor of implying lust. Finally, the author provides the full... And to my great relief, he provided the full transcript of the letter, and I should say delight, too. I read the full letter, and I suddenly felt a little betrayed about the way he had set up the entire scenario of the book using the bits and pieces from the letter in the way to serve that particular bias, because when you read the letter, it's directed to the three of them.
I looked up the word sucker in the Webster Dictionary. I have a friend who has an 1850 dictionary I wanted to borrow, but he was out of town, which says that it means to run to the rescue of, to bring aid. And the Oxford English Dictionary says that sucker means assistance and support in times of hardship and distress, and or to give assistance to. In the very sentence before Joseph used the word sucker, he had already explained the same meaning as found in the dictionaries. Quote, "It would afford me great relief of mind if the three of you would come and see me in my lonely retreat." Throughout the letter, he indicated his desire for a visit from all three of you to comfort me now in the time of my affliction. Again, consistent with the Webster and Oxford Dictionary's definition of succor, and refers to their greater friendship for the risks they are taking. Finally, he states, "One thing I want for you three and I, for you and I, and I." It's difficult to actually get the full context. I guess we'd be guessing. But he says, "One thing I want for you is to get the fullness of my blessing sealed upon our heads." This line alone, to me, suggests that this was something other than a simple sexual tryst that he suggested. It bothers me to think that this letter was used for supposed evidence for the opposite effect of what it may have originally been intended. And I had to ask, he who is good with a hammer thinks everything is a nail. When I was done, I want to tell you that I was very glad that I read this book. It provided such an in-depth look into the context of the circumstances, timing, and identities of the women with whom Joseph Smith married or asked to marry, and the other men and women who subsequently participated in plural marriage in Nauvoo, and the extent and far-reaching impact of Nauvoo polygamy, that I don't think that my perceptions will ever be the same. And it has certainly opened up avenues of study that I would like to pursue because of the thought-provoking subjects that he did bring up. And as a genealogist, I'm, you know, always looking into people's lives, so this was absolutely fascinating. The repetition of the numbers, which some complained about, but I did not, the repetition of the numbers of the men and women involved in Nauvoo polygamy is useful to me. By the time I was finished with the book, I felt that he had wrapped my brain around more of the statistical facts of who, what, when, and where of Nauvoo polygamy. The tables of data in the book represent a huge investment of study and labor that can be used as valuable tools for future reference. What I resisted in the book was the author's why about Joseph Smith and polygamy and his assertions of certain formation, assertion of certain information as facts. The author firmly establishes the importance of Nauvoo polygamy, that it indeed, quote, marked the Latter-day Saints becoming the most prominent theological principle of the religion. For these reasons, by the time I was done reading, I was glad that I had read the book. In summary, the book's weaknesses, and I just chose to reverse the order that he suggested and do the weaknesses first because, you know, that... And it's very difficult because when I'm looking at the book, I'm thinking, what is a weakness of the book and what is my personal take? And I'm, you know, those are kind of blended. I think that one of the things that bothered me was that he used the title of the book, the publisher, signature has such for me a good reputation of providing such a wealth of historical information. And I just took it as a straightforward Mormon history book. But I think that that he actually uses the history as a vehicle to rationalize and thus degrade Joseph Smith's status as a prophet of God and convey him at best as a mere mortal, a very lustful and innovative, imaginative one at that. Perhaps kindler and gentler. It's perhaps kinder and gentler than Dan Vogel's Joseph Smith, Making of a Prophet, which was also published by Signature. I felt that the book denigrates plural marriage with such terms as, quote, menace of plural marriage, quote, marital innovation, quote, marital creation, marital marriage experiment, the culture myth began, the lustful spirit of plural marriage, theological philanderings, indulging in the practice, a controversial experience in marriage, a matter of lust. With similar language, the book denigrates various revelations, doctrines of Mormonism, as well as some practitioners of polygamy, especially Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. The book fails in several places to provide footnotes for assertions that I would therefore call leaps of logic. This is not a major issue, but you know, when there's an assertion of certain points, I think that there ought to be something to back that up. The book asserts that Fanny Alger was not a wife of Joseph Smith, but that his relationship with her was an adulterous affair. The evidence for both sides of this argument are presented, which is valuable to me, but his conclusion was not convincing and seems more derived from bias than from a careful analysis. The author also expends efforts to exonerate John C. Bennett and redeem him from Joseph Smith's condemnation, or at least place him and Joseph Smith on the same level as lecherous men. I thought in the beginning, I'll come back to that maybe. The book's strengths, on the other hand, when I finally got over my revulsion of his revulsion of Joseph Smith's novel of polygamy, provided a large quantity of excellent details, data, and documentary information. Thus, context and a better chronology than I have ever experienced with Nauvoo history. He made connections between that data and the later practice of polygamy in Utah that I have also never seen. He acknowledged genealogical and religious belief connections between Joseph Smith and Nauvoo polygamists and contemporary fundamentalist Mormons. The context and the chronology provokes even more questions. For example, in the margin of page 57, where it points out that Joseph Smith married Louisa Beeman on April 5th, 1841, and the Nauvoo Temple cornerstones were laid on the 6th, I asked in the margin, was Joseph Smith required by God to enter into plural marriage before the foundation stones of the Nauvoo Temple were laid? The other thing that I found very thought-provoking was the concept of a family order of God, the kind of thing that Brigham Young stated about his vision on the plains when they were crossing west, and he said that Joseph Smith appeared to him and told him that he had come to set the, you know, to make better order of the kingdom of God, the family of God. I had an elderly temple worker tell me one time, he said, I don't know many things, but one thing I do know is there's only one family in heaven. And I have this sense that Joseph Smith's polygamy had as much to do with that as, and it's almost beyond my expression to grapple with, but when I look at the information that George provided, my mind was able to wrap around that in to a far greater degree than it has in the past. Another question that the book raised for me was, what about these spiritual experiences by all the other people? I recently read an experience by Sanford Porter, who heard a voice speak to him in 1815 when he was previously, when he had been an atheist, telling him that the Church of God was not on the earth, that it would be restored, and that he would live to see it, and his subsequent experience of conversion. And it seems that even though George has presented phenomenal critique of Joseph Smith's experience, it would be very hard for me to dismiss the multiple other people that did not have a particular connection to Joseph Smith even at the time of their spiritual conversions based on what he has presented.
Are you back?
Yes, I'm on the reliably last. The book's significance is its tremendous contribution to the body of Mormon history and the vast amount of personal and family data of the individuals who were involved in Nauvoo polygamy. Its significance may also serve as a tool to provoke Mormons and others into deeper questionings and thought about the founder of Mormonism and the religion he established, whether for good or for ill. My final thought on this subject is that it seemed a little bit of an attempt to step on the shoe. The editing was superb. You could not complain one iota about the editing. To step on the shoe, but scuff the shine of Joseph Smith and his legacy. But in my book, he did not succeed in that. Joseph Smith still shines through. Thank you.
What I'm going to do is since Mary Ann's given both the negative and the positive, and summed up the contributions, I guess we won't do it in quite the round table way. But I'll let Cheryl go ahead, and she can deal with all three questions, and I'll deal briefly with all three questions. We'll give George a chance to respond. Okay, is that okay with you, Cheryl? Want to modify that? Okay.
Listening to Mary Ann was very instructive. I realized that the reaction to this book is going to show you a lot about yourself as well as George. So now I'm kind of worried about what my remarks are going to show you about me. I want to ask you, first of all, who wrote the poem in the front of the book, George?
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah.
Is that you?
Let me speak while I get a chance.
Yeah, she'll let her.
Do you mind if I read the poem?
No, I don't mind.
Okay, because I am a poet. This is what got me reading the book in the first place, is this poem that he starts out with. And it says, how celestial is marriage, a carriage to higher climes, spousal rhymes of double, treble images, shadows of soft redundancy, which night might you be staying? We can negotiate, but here you are, rippling froth, cresting beer at day's end, a favor here to savor, savior, angel's warning sword, celestial kiss, in this man's world, a right privilege not to miss. Wonderful. I love that poem. And my husband is a historian. He's always telling me that history is a creative reconstruction of the past. And I think that's never so much as when we're writing about Joseph Smith and Mormon polygamy. We all come to this history with our own life's experience, and we go from there. And I feel a lot the same as Mary Ann as I read this book. I felt like, George, that when you describe these events, you're a little titillated, but you're a little scornful, a little condemning, a little grossed out. And I, on the other hand, I'm a little intrigued, and I'm sort of admiring and a little bit reverent also. So I'm going to give you some examples of this, and I'm going to show you how George put it and then how I would put it. The same information, but maybe just a little different wording. And he said on page 3, quote, Mormon polygamy had its own cultural antecedents in the interpretation of Old Testament accounts of Abraham, David, and Solomon. Despite the appeal to the Bible, the reality in the 1800s was that polygamy, for centuries, had been forbidden among Jews and Christians, both in America and Europe. It was illegal on that afternoon in 1841 when the Mormon prophet married Louisa Beeman. Unquote. Now I'm going to use almost exactly the same words and the same information, and I might promote a little bit different view of the past by saying, although polygamy was illegal in the United States on the day that Joseph Smith married Louisa Beeman, and although for centuries it had been forbidden among Jews and Christians alike, the Mormon prophet boldly restored in the 1800s a principle with religious and cultural antecedents which had their roots in the Old Testament account of biblical kings and prophets Abraham, David, and Solomon. And okay, I'm going to do one more. I got such a great response. Okay. another one. This is shorter. George says, quote, he, meaning Joseph Smith, apparently did not want a second mother. Joseph waited until 7 months after his father's death to introduce polygamy as a formal institution involving a sealing ceremony. And I might interpret the same information like this. He must have been disappointed that his father was never able to enter into the principle, as he died 7 months before polygamy was introduced as a formal institution involving a sealing ceremony. And reviewers of this book have noticed several instances of this, and Marianne went into quite detail. And I do see it also over and over again, where your personal feelings on the principle of plural marriage are betrayed. However, I am going to call this a strength of the book. Because, now, I compare this with Todd Compton's book, which I've also been very fascinated with and read. And he is very, a lot of you know that he's very careful to identify certain of Joseph Smith's relationships as probable or possible, and he's just very careful. And you make a lot more inferences than Compton, but this gives us another view of Nauvoo, which may not yet have been addressed. You give us the undercurrents, the rumor, the innuendo. I like that. It was fun to read that. Good historians cannot help but impute motives and draw conclusions. If not, their accounts become very dry indeed, a mere recital of events. And the story you've presented here in Nauvoo Polygamy is interesting. You've made it come alive. I really find that a strength of the book. Now, even though I put this as a strength, one of the questions I'm going to have for you is the following. You frame polygamy as a distasteful practice. Marianne gave you some examples of that. Yet, many of the Nauvoo era followers spoke of it glowingly. What do you find in your research to justify this, or do you think your personal preferences are what slanted your writing this way? Other strengths I find in the book. Chapter 6 gives some accounts of how plural marriage worked in Nauvoo, and I thought there was a great balance in the accounts of the advantages of plural marriage and the difficulties. Chapters 4, 5, and 6, I did also find the real meat of the book. Those three chapters provide well-researched, documented vignettes. There's a lot of good meat in there that hasn't been written about before, and good historical accounts that I really enjoyed reading. That it tells about the emergent social system in Nauvoo and how Nauvoo individuals responded to the presentation and the practice of plural marriage. Chapter 8 was my favorite chapter. It's called In Search of Lost History, and I'm not sure that I really agree with it. because I don't know that following the manifesto, if the connection with plural marriage was lost, but certainly those trends of waxing and waning awareness were there, and I loved reading the detailed information you provided on the collection of the affidavits and the historical research on polygamy and Joseph F. Smith deciding, oh, there's nothing, we've got to find some stuff. I really liked those accounts. Now, where I'm coming from, as a married woman of a certain age, I read the book with just looking for certain things. Although I'm a traditional LDS, I'm also quite certain that a relationship with the powerful, enigmatic, virile prophet of the Restoration would have appealed to me. I have to admit that. Also, his assurances that such a relationship would bequeath salvation to myself and my posterity, I would have totally fallen for that. So, but as this woman that I am, these questions come to my mind, and I'm going to read three questions that were really important to me as I read the book. First, in exploring Joseph Smith's polyandrous marriages, Todd Compton theorizes that the previous civil marriages were considered invalid, and that is why, one of the reasons why, he was able to take other men's wives. Do you agree or have another opinion on Joseph Smith's rationale for polyandry? And polyandry is very interesting to me, and I want to understand it. I want to understand why we moved away from that, why Joseph Smith introduced it, and why it was okay to take someone else's wife, you know. So, The second one is, Compton also makes the point that in the case of two of Joseph Smith's older wives, Fanny Young Murray and Rhoda Richards, the marriages may have been contracted for dynastic reasons, since they were sisters of favorite apostles. And interestingly, Helen Mar Kimball, she's the one everyone gets so upset about because she was so young. She was the youngest wife, 14 years old, and she's often pointed to as an example of Joseph's debauchery. Huh. But she was also, though, the daughter of another loyal apostle. I wanted to know if George thought it was a possibility that this was also a dynastic marriage and not motivated solely by sexual interest. And why are we so quick to dismiss sexual interest towards an older woman, but not towards one who's much younger? Next, why do you suppose that historians writing on the topic of Mormon polygamy neglect to reconcile Joseph Smith's sealing practices of connecting other men to himself and building a family kingdom with his sealing of women as wives? How much were his marriages to polyandrous and older women all about kinship and adoption rather than marriage? That would be interesting too. I wish you had gotten into some of these other issues a little bit more, done a little bit more analysis as you presented your information. Okay, couple of the weaknesses. In your introduction, you state we are able to know both the facts and the human emotions. I don't know that we can know the facts and the human emotions. We can know our own bias. We can examine primary sources and speculate as to their motivations. But unfortunately, we cannot know what the human emotions were or even the facts. How can you, in your book, how can you approach this with such surety? Because you do. You present it as this is how it was. And you don't say, well, maybe Joseph Smith, you know, I think I would have been much more vague on that. I wouldn't have been able to say unequivocally this is what he was thinking. Can you point to any specific details in your research which influenced you to be so unequivocal in describing the human emotions and motivations? And one more thing. About the chapter on the Anabaptists. I know that some see this as a strong strength of the book. I've read people say that they didn't realize that the Anabaptists called themselves Latter-day Saints. They followed a prophet who received new revelation. They called 12 apostles. They reinstituted polygamy and other Old Testament practices. And that the parallels are extraordinary. Well, I don't know that I find the parallels all that extraordinary, and I didn't feel like that chapter in the book fit in with Nauvoo polygamy. I didn't see a connection. You didn't really draw so much of a connection, just those few points that I mentioned you could have done in a paragraph like I just did. And so I didn't feel like it justified the, like, 71 pages. The book was already how long?
700.
700-something pages. And I didn't feel like that this was quite so essential to a discussion of Nauvoo polygamy. I think that is one of the weaknesses of the book. However, I do have a question about that, if I can find it. The LDS have an apologetic position that early saints married mostly older or widowed women as polygamous wives in order to provide support for them, and that's been contested in recent years. Do you find that your study of Anabaptists provides new or additional support for this rationale of polygamy? And the contributions that I feel like you've made, Marianne mentioned the fantastic chart that you have, the, like, 200 men and about 700 women that he's prepared on polygamous marriages in Nauvoo. This is a great contribution. The table is alphabetical by husband's name and then chronological by sealing date. It includes additional details such as marriages and sealing dates, ages of husbands and wives at the time of the marriage. For each husband, the number of wives and children broken down into three time periods: Joseph Smith's life, after Joseph Smith's life but in Nauvoo, and then after Nauvoo. And the book's table also includes sealings in Nauvoo after Smith's death, post-Nauvoo sealings for husbands who were polygamously married at Nauvoo. This was very fascinating. I just pored over the little details of, you know, I don't have any polygamous ancestors, but it was very, very interesting to look at those. So I think that's a great contribution, and it lays a foundation for further study and analysis of LDS groups. I want to end with his end sentence in on the final page of the text. Says, polygamy remains very much on the minds of Mormons today, whether in the LDS Church, the Community of Christ, the Restoration branches, or fundamentalist organizations. Each group looks back to Nauvoo through a different lens. Already you've seen two different lenses of looking at Nauvoo and just reading this book. So I think that this is a wonderful book as a jumping-off place to start to discuss Mormon polygamy. And I thank you for writing that. It's a great day.
Well, I really appreciate the comments and the thoughtful thoroughness that these two authors have gone through. And I'm glad they were able to get the female perspective, since females were affected so directly by the institution of polygamy. When I first encountered George's book, I thought, where is he going to go that Todd Compton hasn't gone? And that was my concern when I first picked up the book. But as I got into it, I saw that it didn't compete with Todd Compton's book so much as it went into a lot of new and insightful areas that Todd alluded to in his book. I mean, Todd's book the research is very thorough, assiduous, and provided a foundation stone for much of the information that George drew on, but he's gone in new and exciting directions. Todd's book, basically, those of you who have read it, I'm sure, how many of you have read Todd's book? It's essentially a collection of biographies, of the wives of Joseph Smith. And in talking about Joseph Smith, you don't really get a sense of the dynamics of his life unfolding and how polygamy unfolded in Nauvoo itself, because Todd's biographical sketches go into the Utah period as well, and so on, and so it goes in the new and exciting directions. And I'm just going to list very quickly, so I want to give George plenty of time to respond to everybody. But the three biggest strengths I see in the book is his charts and tables, and this has been alluded to by the other two people. I mean, they're just nobody's done that and gone there, and just the listing of all of the people in Nauvoo that were involved with polygamy as it unfolded. I had one individual who has written an extensive critique, an Orthodox Latter-day Saint, who has told me, he said, it's worth the price of admission of the book itself, just the charts that are in there. And I concur in that. I really do concur in that. All of the charts, the work and the painstaking effort that went into the construction of those charts. The second attribute, and here I guess I differ with Cheryl, I really was fascinated by the chapter on the Munster Anabaptists for the reasons that she sort of was kind of dismissive of it. I think it really tells us, and I guess I'm approaching this from my perspective of I come out of an LDS background as well, but I'm not an active practicing Latter-day Saint. I would be quite a bit in the other direction. I see this as the detailed description of the type of community that was set up in Munster by John Brockelson. Brockelson. Sorry. You tell I'm not German, even though my wife is. It's eerily similar in terms of the philosophy, the teachings, all the attributes. It's such a haunting the parallels with Joseph Smith in millenarianism, end times, the way he sets himself up as a king, the way the leadership is set up, the things that you mentioned. And that was, to me, that was the most absorbing chapter. I mean, I'm just fascinated with that particular chapter. For me, that was kind of almost worth the price of admission. I was really absolutely fascinated by that particular chapter. And the third big strength I saw in the book is the way, the painstaking way in which George places Joseph Smith within the context of what was going on, not only with the development of Mormonism, theologically, doctrinal, and everything else, but the dynamics of what was going on in Nauvoo during this period. Because as I read, as the core of that discussion is in chapters 2 and 3, and what that really underscored for me was the centrality, the importance of the role that polygamy played in the development of all other aspects of Mormon doctrine and practice during this critical Nauvoo period. And that's something that that Marianne has picked up upon, and she sees that as particularly important with her fundamentalist tradition, because the centrality, how everything was so interwoven with the practice of polygamy, the whole concept of exaltation. You just have to read Doctrine and Covenants section 132 to see that. And I wish you'd have quoted put the whole revelation in there. You put excerpts in there, but I mean, I think if that had been put in there in its entirety, I guess that's one of my little nitpicking things. But it really would underscore how important polygamy was in where Mormon doctrine and theology was at that particular time. Now, as far as the things that I had a few problems with, and I'll go over these very quickly because I think our the other two people have spent a lot more time on that than they did in the positive point, so I'm going to spend less time to try to balance it out a little bit. The writing style, I had a little bit of problems. The writing style is a little bit uneven. It's not as tightly focused as it might be. Repetitive in places, and George sort of wanders off into other topics which don't always are not always dealing with the central story of Nauvoo polygamy. I think you could have summed them up very much more succinctly and much more briefly. A related problem, I guess, would be a little bit on the basic organization of the book, but maybe it's not as much of a critique. I got thinking about this a little bit more. I guess my major problem here is that it was with the chapter on the Munster Anabaptists. I would have placed that at the beginning. I told George this in our phone conversation. Almost did. He said he went back and forth on this issue. The reason why I would have placed it at the beginning is because I feel that would help to present the story of Mormon polygamy within a broader context, showing that what the Mormons are doing with polygamy wasn't all that unique. He does, and it would have had given the book even a greater appeal to an audience outside the Mormon community. I think one of the criticisms I've always had about Mormon studies is we tend to be so insular in the way that we consider Mormonism's past. We don't always see it within the broader historical context of what was going on in the larger society and the larger cosmic realm of reality out there. And then a third criticism I have, and it's been mentioned by the other two the two women here, is the documentation in places is uneven. There's sometimes he makes assertions where there is inadequate attribution or footnotes for those. So, but as I say, I think the bottom line is I think it's an extremely important book, and I don't think anybody can understand Joseph Smith in his totality without reading this book alongside that of alongside the works of other earlier authors, including Todd Compton, Richard Bushman, and I'd even say my alter ego Fawn Brody. I would say that in order to get a complete picture and understanding of Joseph Smith, I think this book is absolutely essential reading, and I see that as the bottom line contribution of this work. Okay. Let's see. Oh, gosh. We got a half hour, so you can go for 10, 15 minutes, and I'll leave it 15 minutes for questions, because we go until 6:15, so you
got
to...
Is that correct?
We go to 6:15? We go to 6:15. Yeah, we got a half hour.
We can go to 6:30.
Pardon?
We can go later if we need to.
Yeah.
we may need to.
Okay.
Well, I guess I should say I needed that.
That was, as Bushman said on Hissing, that wasn't so bad, was it?
I think the reviews, to my view, tell me something about the reviewers. I'm not going to go too far with that, but some of this seems to be in the eye of the beholder. And one sort of topical area maybe is Chapter 9. Somebody wanted Chapter 9 jettisoned, and somebody wanted Chapter 9 to be Chapter 1. I like that. That's not good to me. Because I actually had that that discussion with myself, where to put it, and was it the context within which the story of Joseph Smith, among other utopian groups in early America, could be seen, and would that be a good background? But then, actually, in deciding the order, it seemed that the Mormon audience, the Utah audience, would be largely focused on Joseph Smith himself, and they would say, "What is this?" You know. So I wasn't sure, and it ended up as Chapter 9. Marianne, you're very insightful. That whole idea about the nail. You know, what does a Smith do? He picks up a hammer and he puts it down. That, in fact, is where my name came from. My people picked up hammers and hit nails. So you were very insightful, and I accepted that I welcomed your comments. I also thought... the anxiety of the couple of the reviewers, the first two reviewers, was palpable. I think there was a lot more anxiety about how people look at Joseph Smith, how people look at Mormons, than I think I really gave reason to express. That's my view, and I realize I'm disagreeing with you. But let me give an example. This is Cheryl's, she shared with me a list of her comments, and just the first one, if I might repeat just a little bit, you frame polygamy as a distasteful practice, and then mentioned Smith granting favors to chosen followers, yet many of the Nauvoo followers spoke of it glowingly, and how could you justify this in your research and so forth, and your personal preferences slanted. I would just like to elaborate maybe just on that one point. Going through the book at various points, Joseph Smith chose 33 men to grant wives, which he alternatively called favors and privileges. In one case, on page 244, to William Clayton, he gave the favor of a woman he was still attached to, who was Sarah Crooks in England, a woman that he met on his mission. Brigham Young to William Clayton, he came to give him, quote, a favor, which Clayton had long desired. Another granting of a favor. Joseph Smith saying, it is your privilege to have all the wives you want, or alternatively, you have a right to get all you can. These are the words of Joseph Smith. William Clayton, speaking of Sarah, whom he expects to marry, he says she is willing to comply with her privilege of marrying Clayton. So these words, favor and privilege, were used commonly to refer to plural marriage. Lorenzo Snow, Joseph explained, quote, my duty and privileges in reference to celestial marriage. The late Kimball, writing to Heber, it appears that Joseph has taught Parley his privilege, even appointed one for him. So she is usually privileged as a woman to marry, as a wife. Joseph Smith to William Law, he said, plural marriage was a great privilege granted to the high priesthood. And George A. Smith to Joseph Smith III, he recalls how Joseph Jr., that is, told him not to fall behind in his privileges. So privileges and favors are marriages, women, the events which are central to plural marriage. And so when I use these terms, really quoting Joseph Smith and many of his apostles, I don't think I'm framing polygamy as a distasteful practice, but I do acknowledge that those are unusual terms, and it does sound derogatory, and I was not unaware of that, but I thought that was a curious usage, and it was the way it was expressed. I guess I should mention how the polygamy book got started. It was just one of those stories. You sort of know it's there, and you hear about a plural wife, and you know that Joseph, I heard maybe of a dozen or so, and I asked different people, who are these wives? And people like Michael Quinn, who's really done a lot of studying, Richard Van Wagner, Todd Compton, he and I sort of met in the middle, and we were working on a similar subject at the same time. It was at one point not clear just who these wives are, and especially the plural wives of the other people besides Joseph Smith. Joseph was the first one, apparently, in Nauvoo that had married plural wives. He did, in, as you pointed out in the discussion of 1840, his father died, nine of his apostles were on missions in England. John Bennett, somebody entirely different, came into Nauvoo and set up a Nauvoo charter that made it strong, developed a Nauvoo legion, and was made mayor of the town. Joseph liked him very much, and Joseph gave him a revelation, essentially, promising him various rewards. So this was a changed circumstance. With nine of the apostles gone, Joseph was at that point in 1840 where he spoke about plural marriage. And to Joseph Noble, he invited him into that system, and the next spring, Joseph Noble was the person who married Joseph Smith to Joseph Noble's sister-in-law. Joseph Noble was also married to a Beeman. I appreciated the comments on the Louisa Beeman part. I wanted to make that very clear, that there was no ambiguity that Joseph did begin plural marriage in Nauvoo with Louisa Beeman, and listed all the sources of information, kind of like 1 to 11, which I have to thank Lavina Fielding Anderson for urging me to make very clear, because she suggested some people would not believe it and say that he really didn't do it, and I should just make it exceptionally clear. So the first case of a marriage was, in fact, as clear as I could outline. I didn't list all of his wives by the evidence 1, 2, 3, but just the first one. I did think that the source of of how polygamy developed from the European example, from Munster, Germany, but also from debates in England, and including John Milton, whose wife left him, and he was trying to figure out what to do, and divorce was out of the question. That was illegal from the Apostle Paul from the very beginning of the Christian era. And so he said, why can't I have a second wife? And he wrote this dissertation on the subject, and nobody published it. It was too hot to handle, and it turned out that it was printed, discovered in 1824, published in 1825, and reviewed in the, the Christian Theology, I forget the name of but it was William Ellery Channing who did the reviewing, and this was in, he was very well known as a reviewer, and this was done in London and Boston. Now that's 1826. It was 1825 when Joseph met Emma on a trip to Harmony, Pennsylvania, and they married in the beginning of 1827, almost coincident with the time that Milton had posthumously broadcast his dissertation on plural marriage. And of course there were other people who had various forms of marriage. There were the Cochranites in Maine, and the Oneida Perfectionist Society had kind of a group marriage, no husband-wife combinations, but everyone was sort of in a marriage to each other, and there were all sorts of utopian experiments trying to develop a better society, sharing goods, taking away the things that bring difficulty in a community, and marriage was certainly considered one of those, apparently. So it was a very exciting time that Joseph Smith entered into, and I was really thrilled to be working on the book. It was very hard for me. And I'm glad there were parts of it that you, the three critics, liked. And I would encourage you to write and rewrite the book and take the subject and expand it.
I just take it off.
Yeah, and take it somewhere else. There probably are more wives. There are a list of possible wives. There are probably more families involved. I had an unusual experience. I had given a book to someone, and this was an executive in one of the nation's largest four banks. And his wife, he said, I think you're in this chart in the end here. I think this is your great grandfather, or whatever, from Nauvoo. And now they started looking over this. I was just, very surprised to see that, but it does reach out in a lot of directions. And anyway, thank you for the opportunity of letting me respond to this. And maybe you have a counter response.
Does anybody have a counter response? Well, this is turning out the way I wanted to, in terms of we got 15 minutes for questions, and so I guess step forward to the microphone and ask your question. People that have questions, must be questions. Here we go.
I'm afraid to ask this, but I will anyway.
and direct it to whom you want to respond.
This is directed to Marianne and George. I'll read the statement and I'll ask the question. One of the evils of Mormon polygamy led to widespread lying and dishonesty. From Joseph...
Is it on? Is it on?
Can you hear him?
You can go to the...
Yeah, why don't you come up here to the front?
Can you hear it now?
No. Come on up here. I obviously, we've got problems with microphones here today. This one works fine. Just speak in there.
I was terrified before, but now I don't know if I can get through it. One of the evils of Mormon polygamy lived in widespread lying and dishonesty, from Joseph's adamant denials, my grandparents dissembling in the late 19th century, to the period between 1890 and 1912, when polygamous marriages were still being entered into, to the present day eluding, I'm not sure that's a good word, but kind of skating over the idea that this Mormon doctrine is eternal and will be practiced in heaven. My question is, why was Joseph Smith such a wimp? Here he was, a prophet of God, had to face down these angels with drawn swords, clothed in the robes of the holy priesthood, afraid to tell his wife. And Marianne, is there an answer to that, or George, is an answer to that? Why was he afraid to tell his wife?
Go ahead, Marianne. Then I'll let George. Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah. Repeat that.
He said all men don't have reason for that.
Oh, touche. My husband and I discussed this very question about Emma, and as I read George's book, my perception after being a sixth generation Mormon, where polygamy has never ceased from the days of Nauvoo, my perception is that he did talk to Emma, and that Emma knew, and that Emma had to be reconverted every morning.
Had to be reconverted?
Had to be reconverted. I think he talked to her as early as 1831. I think that she struggled with it. And I think that he was very kind in trying to work with her, and did. I think that ultimately she said, you know, she came to a point where she didn't want him to talk about it and made it very clear to him. But that's my perception.
George?
Well, I think Emma actually was very kind to Joseph in many of the instances, and some of them came from the Clayton Journal. William Clayton was Joseph Smith's personal secretary, his private clerk, and he wrote down these incidents where somebody would be passing a letter to Joseph, or somebody's watch. Maybe Emma's watch is a gold watch, and the one of the plural wives she wasn't aware of, it seemed like, had the watch, and there was property and transfers of messages, and I think maybe the most difficult part was the revelation which Joseph dictated in 1843, where, speaking for the deity, Joseph says, if Emma doesn't go along with Joseph's wives, she will be destroyed. And I think she saw that as, there he goes again. There was a lot of family in there, and as well as we look at it, perhaps from a view, this is a sacrosanct event, a revelation in 1843, Emma didn't seem to consider that sacrosanct at all. And as we know, she destroyed it. Of course, Joseph allowed her to destroy it. He had it copied first, and the copy was maintained. So I think there was a lot of give and take. William Law takes the position that Emma did know more about polygamy than we might otherwise think, and that she was part of what Law saw as Joseph's scheme to gain access to the funds of some of the families of the wives. Maria and Sarah Lawrence had an estate which Joseph served as executor for, and so he had a fiduciary responsibility, generating a conflict of interest. He's marrying a young woman for whom he's the executor of her father's estate. Law says that Emma was part of this as a plan to gain access to assets. And you could pursue that. I didn't really pursue that, but there are lots of avenues of discussion. I don't know if I have a firm feeling on one answer or the other, but it's a very interesting subject.
George, this is my chance to have a dialogue with you that I requested, but you didn't give to me.
Oh, I got your letter, and I have changed a lot of things.
Oh.
Seriously.
Then I don't have to go into too much detail.
Well, I appreciate it.
Anyway, I was so excited. Well, I have great respect for this book. It's just that it perpetuated some errors in my family that I have been trying hard to correct. I was very excited when this book was coming out. I thought, oh, it's going to be up to date. At least there's going to be correct information about my great-great-grandmother, Mary Ann Frost Stearns Pratt, who was Parley's second monogamous wife. I rushed to buy it. I could hardly wait. I ran up the stairs, bought it, got back in my car, took off about a block away. It was a parking lot. And so I pulled in, opened the book, and I started reading. And I was just crestfallen. And I took it back. I called them and I said, can I bring this book back, please? It just is not going to do anything for me in this one respect. And other ways, I'm sure it has. I've read it, and so the problem with me was the accuracy. It seemed to use a lot of Reba Stanley's information, which was she was one of the descendants of one of the plural wives and wrote much later. I think she was a great-granddaughter of Phoebe Sulfur. I don't know, there were wrong dates for the wives, there were wrong ages that were being compared. He had my great-great-grandmother's sister, Olive, living with them in Kirtland. You might consider each one sort of a small thing, but put all together, it was very disturbing to me, and I thought, I don't think there's been anybody that's done much research on this or were concerned that they were getting the right information at all. And particularly, I guess, because I am writing my great-great-grandmother's biography. And so, of course, I'm interested in her life and that she be honored. She was, Parley said things about her the same as Joseph had said about Mary Ann. And it's been my purpose, actually, since 1966, and then we've been gone all over the place, and then I came back to Salt Lake, and I worked really hard to make this accurate. And so,
but to be fair, you disagree with all the historians, don't you, on these names and dates?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Thanks.
I do, because these things have all been
repeated
and added upon, and it just absolutely unbelievable. And so, anyway, that's been my purpose.
Not yours,
but I wanted to take this chance to say, how come you didn't get back to me? Because you're talking here, they're saying that right at the first, what a wonderful person you were for dialogue and getting things right.
All right.
Let me answer.
So why did you call me?
All right. I'm going to answer.
I spent a lot of time on that letter. I'm just really...
Okay. Well, the answer is that I received a lot of the information where there were increments that I could use. I did. I saw a kind of an argument between your information and Reba Stanley's, as you pointed out. And there's some... you say she's out to lunch. It's anyway, there were some areas where I was able to change in the manuscript. This is after the publication, of course.
I know. That's...
And... But why I didn't get back to you, that's one of my human failings. I was probably writing an article or something like that. All right.
Ask her the question. She's going to publish her book.
Oh, yes. And the question is, when are you going to publish your book? Which I would really like to say.
Martin is helping me finish pulling it together.
You've got a good person.
And, so it's just, she needed to have her voice heard. Harley said she was wicked of the person she was going to help. And I
talking
in
the microphone.
Read,
yeah.
Redeemed her.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. We must have some. We got about time maybe for one or two more questions. Oh, come on up here. Come on.
Is there any documentation that Joseph Smith had children with other than Emma?
Oh, that's a good question. Okay. That's the golden question.
You have just asked the golden question, I'm told. There is lots of imperfect documentation that won't carry you through to the finish line. I don't think we really know. There's been some DNA studies, genetic studies, to exclude the possibility of some who people thought might have been children. There, what we have is a testimony of several of the wives or families of wives that they had a child or they knew of a child. Someone said she knew of two or three children. I don't know that there's any way to answer that. There's this Temple Lot case, which they took testimony for in 1892. Melissa Lot explained that she was married to the prophet. She lived with him. They lived together as husband and wife. She acknowledged they had no children. The questions about why, she said, well, maybe it's a circumstance, maybe it's conditions, maybe it's my fault. He was being sought by the sheriff. Things were very tense. You know, it wasn't just a one-to-one marriage relationship. And so she admitted, we slept together, but we did not have children. Now, even that, you have to. Some people might not accept that. Some people would, but that's where it is in terms of the testimony. And there is Sylvia Sessions apparently had a child of Joseph, but the DNA tests have not come out to either include or exclude. Although that was given quite a bit of acceptance in Bountiful. There were people involved in the community, in the church hierarchy that seemed to support that family association. But, you know, we don't really know. That's probably the best likelihood. It's an incomplete answer. Did you want to... You've done some studies on this. Do you want to respond to that?
Studies on that, or?
Oh, okay. I would agree with you.
Okay. Well, on that uncertain note, I guess we'll terminate our session and thank you very much for coming.